It worked.
Wow. I got new technology here, so Michael set me up. We're good to go. Just give you a teaser. This stone, and we'll get into it in a few minutes, the inscriptions on this stone directly affect what takes place through the rest of the book of Acts. So there's your teaser. But before we go there, I want to look at a little bit of Jewish history and some of the things that are going on over in Israel today. We're going to find Paul in the temple this morning there in Jerusalem. Time period about 58-59 AD in Solomon's temple. It will only be about another 10 years before the temple is destroyed, interestingly enough. You know, we're getting close to the end of the Jewish temple, and Jerusalem will be destroyed by the Roman armies in about 10 years. But a little bit of history on the temple. Solomon, King Solomon in the Old Testament, built the original temple right around 950 BC. The Jews worshiped there for a couple of hundred years. It was destroyed by the Babylonians around 600 BC. So it had a life of about 350 years before the destruction by the Babylonians. And of course, the reason for the destruction of the Babylonians is because Israel had, Judah had wandered away from the Lord and was worshiping idols. And God had sent his prophets and warned them that if they didn't repent, that armies would come in from Babylon and destroy them. Of course, they didn't repent, and that's exactly what took place. About 530 BC, under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, the temple was rebuilt. So the second temple was built on the Temple Mount. And around 20 BC, King Herod, trying to appease the Jews, because the Jews didn't really like Herod much, expanded the temple into this beautiful place that it was said in the Roman Empire. If you haven't seen Herod's temple, you haven't really seen a building, you know, in the empire, because it was so beautiful, and the expansion work that he had done. And it took place between about 20 BC and 30 AD. And then again, about 70 AD, the temple was destroyed. So with that background on the temple, later on in the Temple Mount, about 700 AD, so a little more than 600 years after the second temple had been destroyed, the Muslims constructed the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the site of the original temple. That was about 700 AD. It was destroyed by an earthquake about 746 AD, and then it rebuilt about 754 AD, destroyed by another earthquake in 1033 AD, and then the current mosque that is on the Temple Mount today was built about 1035 AD. And so you've got the Jewish temple and the Jewish occupation of the Temple Mount going all the way back to 1,000 years before Christ, and the Muslim mosque being built 700 years after Christ. So just keep in mind those time periods, okay? In April of 2016, UNESCO, which is the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, I'm reading this from this article, I think it was in the Jerusalem Post, just rewrote history, announcing that the Temple Mount in Jerusalem is an exclusive Muslim holy place and has no connection to the Jewish people or their religion whatsoever. Oops. Last week, UNESCO adopted a resolution which refers to Israel as the occupying power in Jerusalem on what UNESCO calls the Al-Haram al-Sharif, which is the Temple Mount, the Western Wall, that is today's Judaism's holiest site, is referred to in this resolution as Al-Barak Plaza. And so they've renamed all the Jewish holy sites in Israel with Muslim names. UNESCO's resolution claimed Israel is planning Jewish fake graves in other spaces of the Muslim cemeteries near the Temple Mount, and falsely accused Israel of the continued conversion of many Islamic and Byzantine remains in the so-called Jewish ritual baths or Jewish prayer places. So as more and more biblical things are being uncovered, The UN is saying, well, these are really Muslim things that the Jews are claiming for themselves, you know. They're in Israel. The organization claimed that Israel doesn't respect the integrity, authenticity, or cultural heritage of Al-Aqsa Mosque as a Muslim holy site of worship and as an integral part of the World Cultural Heritage Site. When Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu heard of this, he was a little upset. Says, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reacted furiously to the new UNESCO resolution. This is yet another absurd UN decision. UNESCO ignores the unique historic connection of Judaism to the Temple Mount, where the two temples stood for thousands of years, and to which every Jew in the world has prayed for thousands of years. The UN is rewriting a basic part of human history and has again proven that there is no low to which it will not stop. Later on, he offered to hold a seminar on Jewish history for all the UN workers in Israel, and I don't think he was taken up on it. So just to give you an idea. Now, we come to this. This stone, well, let me read you what Josephus said. Josephus was a Jewish historian in the first century and actually witnessed the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. So he was alive at the time Paul was visiting Jerusalem here. In Josephus' book, The Jewish Wars, he wrote that there were throughout the temple. Now, remember, the temple was divided into three sections. Actually, more than that, but generally, the outer court was called the court of the Gentiles, and Gentiles and seekers who were not Jewish could come into the court of the Gentiles and worship there and pray there and give their offerings there. And many of Jesus' teachings were there in the court of the Gentiles. Then, going through the court of the Gentiles, there was a gate that led you into the court of women, and that's where the Jewish women could go and worship. And then there was the court of the Jews, and only Jewish men could go into that section. And then, of course, there was the holy place where the altars were, and then the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant would have stood. Well, Josephus records that in the walls of the court, between the court of the Gentiles and the court of the women, were several plaques, warning signs. This happens to be one of them that was discovered. And it said, in this balustrade at regular intervals, this is what Josephus says, in the balustrade at regular intervals stood slabs giving warning, some in Greek, others in Latin characters, of the law of purification, to wit that no foreigner was permitted to enter the holy place. So Josephus, back 2,000 years ago, records that in the Jewish temple, there were these warning signs that said, no Gentiles beyond this spot, because they were not permitted to go into the court of the Jewish women and in the court of the men. The Gentiles had to stay outside. This particular stone was found in 1871 in Jerusalem. At the time, Judea was under the Ottoman Empire, which was basically Turkey, and under Muslim control. And one of the archaeological digs found this stone, and it was one of the original stones from the temple in Jerusalem in the wall in the court of the Gentiles. And it says, no stranger or Gentile is to enter within the balustrade around the temple and enclosure. Whoever is caught will be responsible to himself for his death, which will ensue. So that was the warning. Josephus wrote about it 2,000 years ago. This plaque was discovered in Jerusalem 140 years ago, and it's now in a Muslim museum in Istanbul, Turkey, interestingly enough. One of the other plaques was, a fragment of it was found, which said the same thing, and that's in a museum in Israel. So there's evidence here that there was a temple in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount, and they've got the warning signs, and they've got them in a Muslim museum, which is interesting because the Muslims are trying to rewrite all of Jewish history, saying that the Jews have no claim to the Temple Mount, you know, and yet they've got this plaque in their museum, which is kind of interesting. So with that background, let's go into Acts chapter 21. Worked, Mike. Good job. Thank you. Where we left Paul off 2 weeks ago, he had traveled from his third missionary journey, had come back with an offering and several Gentile believers coming to Jerusalem. He was coming here probably for the Feast of Pentecost, coming to worship at the temple and celebrate the feast, coming to bring the offering that had been raised in the Gentile churches to the poor Jerusalem church and to help the poor there because of the droughts and things that they had experienced over the past several years. And also his heart was to win his fellow Jews to the Lord. He sort of suspects this is his last time into Jerusalem. His desire is to go from here to Rome, to Spain, and we saw that a couple weeks ago. He speaks of that in the book of Romans. And so he's probably kind of figuring this is his last time there with his Jewish brethren. He had been a Pharisee, probably a member of the Sanhedrin. And as we saw, his heart's desire was that these men would be saved, would come to a knowledge of Jesus Christ as their Messiah, as their Savior. And so Paul comes back with that idea. And so in chapter 21, the beginning of chapter 21, he comes into town with some of the Gentile brothers, Luke being with them, possibly Timothy. And they go and they meet with James and the elders there in the church of Jerusalem. And James says, you know, there's been a lot of bad things being said about you, Paul, amongst the Jewish believers here. They say that you're teaching against the temple. You're teaching against the law of Moses. That you're telling Jews in these other Gentile cities not to follow the law, not to get circumcised, not to give up their Jewish heritage. And so it's caused a lot of problems here in Jerusalem amongst the believers, you know. And so we need you to bridge the gap, you know, and show the Jews here that, you know, you haven't been teaching these things. And one way to do that is by example. And so let's go up to verse 18 in chapter 21. We're going to attempt to get through chapter 23 today, so I might be motoring pretty quickly. On the following day, Paul went in with us. Here again, Luke's with him. Luke's writing this account. To James, and all the elders were present. And when he greeted them, he told in detail all the things that God had done amongst the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord. And they said to him, you see how many myriads of Jews there are who have believed? You know, look around the city. He says, our church, we got a mega church here. All these Jews have come to the Lord and they've believed. And they are all zealous for the law. So they were still being good Jews, but, and today we would call them Messianic Jews. You know, they're still holding to their Jewish traditions and all, but they've come to a knowledge of Jesus as Messiah. And so they're believers, but they're still, you know, following many of the Jewish rituals and all. And they have been informed about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children nor walk according to the customs. What then? The assembly must certainly meet, for they will hear that you have come. You know, that when the church gathers, they're going to want to hear from you, Paul. Therefore, do what we tell you. We have four men who have taken a vow. This was a Jewish vow, similar to the vow of the Nazarite that was talked about in the Old Testament. Take them and be purified with them. In other words, you know, share in this vow with them, this Jewish vow. Be purified with them. go through all the ritual washings, and they had to have their head shaved and that kind of thing. Pay their expenses. They would have had to have bought sacrifices and paid alms and things like that for this vow. So that they may have their head shaved, that all may know that those things of which they were informed concerning you are nothing, but that you yourself also walk orderly and keep the law. But concerning the Gentiles who believe, we have written and decided that they should observe no such thing, except they should keep themselves from the things offered to idols, from blood, and from things strangled, and from sexual immorality. And we talked about Paul's reasoning here. You know, he wanted to win people to Christ. He wanted to win his Jewish brothers to Christ. And if, you know, if he could remove stumbling blocks to open up the way for the gospel, he was willing to do that. He was trying to be a peacemaker here. He writes to the Romans, as much as is possible with you, live peaceably with all men. Paul's trying to do that here so that he can win some of the Jews, you know, and he can ease the... Paul writes many times in his letters about unity. You know, seek the unity of the brethren. You know, it doesn't mean compromising on essential things, but there's certain things that aren't big enough deal for us to fight over, you know? Baptizing infants or baptizing adults, you know, that shouldn't be a dividing point in the church, you know? If we all believe in Jesus Christ, if they believe that, that's fine. You know, I once had a guy come to the church for a while, and he decided he wanted to have his child baptized. And so I said, that's great. You know, go have him baptized. And when he grows up and is saved, I'll baptize him the right way. He hasn't come back yet, but I was kidding. He knew that. We both laughed about it. But, you know, so Paul's trying to build a bridge here to the Jewish brethren. And, so that there wouldn't be a division, a dividing wall. So then in verse 26, Paul took the men the next day, and having purified with them, so he goes through the ritual washings and all that that they were going through, he enters the temple to announce the expiration of the days of the purification. It would have probably been about a 7-day period that they would have gone through this vow and the washings and all that kind of thing. So, you know, they're coming to the end of this period, at which time an offering should be made for each one of them. And now when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews from Asia, these were the guys from Ephesus and the different places that Paul has ministered that were against him back there, they're here to worship at Pentecost and celebrate the Feast of Pentecost. And they recognize Paul. They had run him out of some of their other cities and tried to put him to death. You know, and so now they're down in Jerusalem and they see Paul walking into the temple. So these Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him. Now, Paul will be the cause of 3 riots in the next 2 chapters. So what they say, they cry out, "Men of Israel, help." So they grab Paul and they scream out, you know, and the temple, you got to kind of get this picture. If this is during a feast time, Israel had probably about a population of maybe 200,000. But during the feast times, Josephus says that they would swell to almost 2 million people. And they would come and they would worship at the temple and, you know, there for the Feast of Pentecost. And so there's a multitude of Jews here in the temple. And so these couple of guys grab Paul, start screaming out for help. "This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against the people, the law, and this place. And furthermore, he has also brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." So they're accusing Paul of taking Greeks past that plaque. "He's brought Greeks into our temple. He's defiling our temple." "For they had previously seen Trophimus, an Ephesian, with him in the city." They didn't see any Gentiles in the temple. They just saw Paul hanging out with them in the city. And so they made this assumption that Paul had brought them into the temple. So they didn't even have their facts right. they just react to Paul. They want to accuse him of anything. So here's their opportunity. This guy's brought Gentiles into our temple. He's defiled our temple. And they saw him down at the marketplace, you know, buying burritos or something, you know, with these guys. And they were kosher burritos. It was in Jerusalem. I just want you to know that. But and so they, you know, they don't see actually the Gentiles in the temple. They just make an assumption. You know, he's brought them in, past this plaque, and a riot breaks out. All the city was disturbed, and the people ran together. They seize Paul, drag him outside the temple. They slam the gates shut. And now as they were seeking to kill him, news came to the commander of the garrison that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. So we've talked before, you had the temple there on the Temple Mount, and then the Romans, who of course were governing that whole area, had put the Antonia Fortress right next to the temple because they knew if something was going to break out, it was going to happen in the temple. And so, you know, they were able to look into the temple area from their fortress to see if anything was going on. And the Roman commander, it was his job to keep the peace. And if he couldn't keep down an uprising, he was in big trouble in Rome, and they would send him, exile him out somewhere, or even have him put to death. And so he wants to quell anything that's going on here. So he's got a stake in all this. And so word gets back to Rome that they're in to the Antonia Fortress, to the Roman commander, that there's a riot breaking out in the temple area. Verse 32, and he immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. So Paul's already getting a whooping from these guys. You know, they're beating on Paul. Down comes the Romans. They've got their breastplates and their helmets and their swords and their shields and their spears and all. And so, they stopped beating on Paul and stepped back. And the commander came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains. Okay, this guy's got to be a troublemaker for all this. You know, so they bind him. And he asked who he was and what he's done. So he's there in the crowd. They're binding him up. So he says, who is this guy and what's he done? Right? So now you got a multitude of angry people just yelling at him, all kinds of accusations, you know. And so some of the multitude cried one thing, some cried another. So when he could not ascertain the truth because of the tumult, he commanded him to be taken into the barracks. So they dragged Paul back up towards the Antonia Fortress so he can question Paul himself. And when he had reached the stairs, he had to be carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob. I mean, this is a full-out riot on a false accusation against Paul. Now, if you remember, Paul had been warned in every city in his last journey that, Paul, if you go to Jerusalem, you're going to be persecuted, you're going to be bound in chains, you know. And they tried to warn him, Paul, don't go, don't go. And he said to the Ephesian elders, I believe it was, hey, look, none of these things move me, you know. I am willing to go and die if that's what the Lord wants, you know, because my life isn't my own. And so we see, up in Caesarea, I believe it was, Agabus the prophet came. He said, Paul, give me your belt. So he gives him his belt. So he wraps up himself and says, this is what's going to happen to the guy that owns his belt. You know, so he had a graphic vision of what was happening. So here, all these prophecies have been told to Paul are coming to fruition. It's taking place for Paul. And so they carry him up the steps because of the mob that wants to tear him in half. For the multitude of the people followed after, crying out, away with him. Then, as Paul was about to be led into the barracks, he said to the commander, may I speak to you? And he speaks to him in Greek, which shocks the commander. He says, can you speak Greek? Are you not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a rebellion and led 4,000 assassins into the wilderness? Let me give you a little background on that statement. Around this time, according to Josephus, the historian again, there were groups of assassins. These guys were like terrorists. And, you know, throughout Israel's history, whenever they were occupied by the Greeks or the Romans or whoever, these false messiahs would rise up, try to start an uprising, gather men to themselves, and try to overthrow whatever power was over Judea at that time. And so there was these bands of assassins, and they were also known as dagger men because they would carry little daggers under their coats. And when it was a feast or a crowd or something, they would pick out a Roman soldier or whatever and go and stab him and kill him clandestinely, you know. And so this one particular assassin had gathered 4,000 men to himself, proclaiming himself to be a false messiah. He was going to overthrow the Roman government. And this is how we're going to do it. We're going to do it by guerrilla tactics, by terrorism, you know, kind of thing. And it's interesting because there's nothing new under the sun. Apparently, the Romans had a terrorist watch list, and this assassin happened to be on the list. But Josephus also says that these guys would lead their followers out into the wilderness and try to perform miracles like Moses had, and try to convince them that they were the Messiah. You know, and so this guy drags Paul in. Hears him speaking Greek. Paul says, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? He says it in Greek. And so the Roman commander says, are you not the Egyptian? And this is probably a Jewish man from Alexandria, which was from Egypt, that had come in and tried to lead an uprising. It's on the Roman terror watch list. Are you not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a rebellion and led the 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness? Paul's going, who? Not me. Paul said, I am a Jew from Tarsus, not Egypt, in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city. What he means is Tarsus was actually the capital city of the area of Cilicia. He says, I'm from Tarsus, a very important city. I'm a citizen of that city. I'm not this Egyptian guy that you're talking about. I don't even know who you mean, you know. And he says, I implore you, permit me to speak to the people. You know, Paul's got this great big gathering of Jews now who have all of their attention on him. He says, what a great opportunity to preach the gospel, you know. They want to kill him, but he's okay with that, you know. Just give me one more chance to share the Lord with them. And so, amazingly enough, the commander gives him permission. So verse 40, Paul stood on the stairs and motioned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great silence, he spoke to them in the Hebrew language. And so Paul was an intelligent man, and he was educated. He speaks to the Jews in Hebrew, and he speaks to the Roman soldier in Greek. You know, and so he was probably trilingual. He probably also spoke Latin, because that was a prevalent language at the time also. So now he's up on the stairs in front of the Antonia fortress. All the Jews are there in the courtyard screaming and yelling. Paul waves his hand and they all get silent. And he speaks to them in Hebrew. And he says, brethren and fathers, hear my defense before you now. And when they heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they kept all the more silent. Okay, what's this guy got to say? Then he said, I am indeed a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, taught according to the strictness of our father's law, and was zealous towards God as you all are today. So Paul starts off trying to find common ground with these guys. He says, look, I'm a Jew just like you guys are. Even though I was born in Tarsus in Cilicia, I was raised here in the city. We'll actually find out that he's got a sister that lives in Jerusalem. And he says, I was taught at the feet of Gamaliel. We've run into Gamaliel earlier in the book of Acts. He was the leading rabbi and teacher of the time. Going and sitting at the feet of Gamaliel was like going to Harvard or Yale or Oxford. You know, it was the best education that a Jewish boy could get if he was going to be a rabbi or a Pharisee. You know, he says, I sat under the feet of Gamaliel. I was trained by him. I was raised here in Jerusalem. I was zealous for the law, just like you are, you know. I was where you are, you know, is what he's saying to them. I persecuted this way, speaking of the believers, the Christians, to the death, binding and delivering into prison both men and women. As also the high priest bears me witness. It was the high priest that gave him the letters to go to Damascus to have people arrested. And all the council of the elders, that's the Sanhedrin, from whom I also received letters to the brethren and went to Damascus to bring in chains, those who were there to Jerusalem to be punished. You know, I had gotten letters from the chief priest and the elders to go to Damascus, and we know the story, and bring them back here to have them convicted of heresies because they were following Jesus. But now it happened, and now Paul, and this is the first time we've come across this in the book of Acts, we heard the account of Paul's conversion as he related to Luke back in, I think it was chapter 9, but now we're hearing it out of Paul's own word, you know, out of his own mouth. And he fills in a little more detail that we don't have from the other account. He said, "Now it happened as I journeyed and came near Damascus, at about noon, suddenly a great light from heaven shone around me. And I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?' So I answered, 'Who are you, Lord?' And he said to me, 'I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting.' And those who were with me indeed saw the light and were afraid, but they did not hear the voice of him who spoke to me. So I said, 'What shall I do, Lord?' And the Lord said to me, 'Arise and go into Damascus, and there you will be told all the things which are appointed for you to do.' And since I could not see for the glory of that light, being led by the hand of those who were with me, I came into Damascus. Then a certain Ananias, a devout man according to the law, having a good testimony with all the Jews who dwelt here, there, came to me, and he stood and said to me, 'Brother Saul, receive your sight.' And at that same hour, I looked up at him. Then he said, 'The God of our fathers.'" You know, he's keeping this very Jewish, if you notice, you know. Their issue was with the Gentiles. So he's keeping this as Jewish as he can, you know, to make them see that, you know, he's one of them. And that, so he says, "The God of our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, has chosen you that you should know his will and see the just one," speaking of Jesus, "and hear the voice of his mouth." There are several times in the book of Acts and also in Paul's writings that he refers to the fact that he saw the Lord. In fact, in a little while, we'll see that the Lord appears to him in prison there in Jerusalem. He talks about himself being an apostle at a due time to who the Lord appeared after his resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15. And so Ananias says to him there, "You've been chosen by God, the God of our fathers, that you should know his will, see the Lord Jesus Christ, who had been put to death and resurrected, and hear the voice of his mouth," you know, and the Lord would speak to him on several occasions. He appears to him here on the road to Damascus and speaks to him. You know, "Lord, Lord, who are you?" You know, "I am Jesus, who you are persecuting." And so Paul is sharing these things. This is what Ananias told me would take place with me. "For you will be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard." Notice he hasn't gone Gentile yet. He's all men. You know, so they're still listening. "And now why are you waiting? Arise and be baptized. Wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. And now it happened when I returned to Jerusalem." If you go back to chapter 9 of Acts, if you want to follow the line here, Saul goes to, he's on his way to Damascus to persecute the Christians, gets converted on the road, gets led into Damascus, meets with Ananias, receives his sight, spends a little bit of time there. Persecution rises there from the Jews, so he gets let down out of a basket in the middle of the night so he can escape. Goes to Jerusalem, spends some time there, and then hears that the Jews there are after him, so he escapes and heads up and ends up in Antioch. So he refers to that here. He says, "Now it happened when I returned to Jerusalem from Damascus that I was praying in the temple that I was in a trance, and I saw him." So here he's referring to a time when he sees the Lord. He says, "I saw him when I was in the temple praying, and I'm in a trance. And he said to me, 'Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me.' And so I said, 'Lord, they know that in every synagogue I imprisoned and beat those who believe on you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by consenting to his death.'" That kind of gives you an idea that he was a member of the Sanhedrin, because he's saying here, "I voted to have him put to death." You know, and so a member of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court, would have taken part in that. "And guarding the clothes of those who were killing him." You know, so he's kind of arguing with the Lord. "You want me to leave, but Lord, I've got this great testimony I can share with them. I was persecuting the Christians, you know, and yet you converted me, you know, and I can tell them all these experiences, you know, and all that." And the Lord says, "Paul, time to get out of town, because they're not going to listen to you." "Then he said to me, 'Depart, for I will send you far from here to the Gentiles.'" That was the magic word. "And they listened to him until this word. And when they raised their voice, and then they raised their voices and said, 'Away with such a fellow from the earth. He is not fit to live.'" The Jews did not have a very high opinion of Gentiles. We've known this all along. You know, they didn't like Samaritans. They hated the Romans. They hated Gentiles. In fact, it was a teaching of the rabbis at the time that the reason God had created Gentiles was to use them as logs in hell to flame the fires. You know, that was they considered the Gentiles as being these mangy, scroungy, wild dogs, you know. And now Paul says, "God chose me to take his message to the Gentiles." Well, that was it. You know, that started the second riot. So off we go again. It's the last word Paul gets a chance to tell these guys. So now they're screaming, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live." Now, he's speaking to them in Hebrew. The Roman commander is just watching this, and everything's peaceful for a while. And then all of a sudden, you know, the whole thing gets set off again. Verse 23, "Then as they cried out and tore off their clothes and threw dust in the air, the commander ordered him to be brought back into the barracks." You know, let's get this guy out of here. "And they said, and he said that he should be examined under scourging, so that he might know why they shouted so against him." This guy has no idea what's happening here. Paul's been talking to them in Hebrew, you know, and all of a sudden this riot breaks out. So he says, "Let's get this guy back in. Let's scourge him and get it, you know, find out what he said to them. You know, what in the world caused this riot? What's going on here?" Scourging was one, not only a punishment, but it was a way of getting a confession, or if they thought there was a conspiracy, getting the guy to give up his conspirators, you know. It was, and so they would beat a confession out of a guy, you know. And the way the implements that they used was usually a leather strap with pieces of metal, pieces of glass in it, so it would just tear the back up, and it would be so excruciating. The guy would go, "Okay, that's enough. I'll tell you whatever you want to know," you know. So he says, "I got to get the truth out of this guy. So let's beat it out of him." So he takes him in to have him scourged. And as they bound him with thongs, this is leather straps, Paul said to the centurion who stood by, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?" We saw this in Philippi. Paul was in prison, beaten, you know, and they let him out, and the people in Philippi, the leader said, you know, "Let's just kind of let him go at night." And Paul says, "Oh, no. They've beaten a Roman citizen. They've imprisoned me without a cause. They got to come and apologize to me." Well, here he says, he's using the Roman citizen card again. You know, it's against the law to kind of like beat a Roman citizen if he hasn't been condemned and there's no cause. That sent shockwaves through the Roman soldiers here. And then the centurion heard that, and he went and he told the commander, saying, "Take care what you do, for this man is a Roman." You know, if a Roman soldier mistreated a Roman, the Roman soldier's head was on the block, you know. So if you were a Roman citizen, you had high privileges. So Paul says, "Hey, I'm a Roman citizen here." And so he goes and he tells the commander. This poor guy, his head must be spinning at this point, you know. Then the commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" And he said, "Yes." The commander answered, "Well, with a large sum, I obtained my citizenship." You know, if you were not a Roman, you could buy your citizenship. And he says, "It cost me a lot of money to buy my citizenship." So this guy wasn't a born Roman. You know, he bought into it. And Paul said, "I was born a citizen." That's a higher level, you know. I was born a Roman. And immediately, you know, it's kind of interesting when you look at Paul's life, how God had prepared him for all these situations throughout his life, you know. He was a Roman, brought up in this mixture of a Roman, Gentile, a Greek, Jewish city up in Antioch, you know. So he had that whole mix of the culture. God was preparing him to take the message of the gospel to the Gentiles. You know, so he gave him that whole background. We saw that he knew the Greek philosophers, and he had read their writings and all. And being a Roman citizen, you know, he was able to get out of some of these situations. But being a Jew, you know, he was able to relate to the Jews. You know, so God had prepared this guy specifically for the work that he was going to do. And so he says, "I was born a citizen." I love this. I can see the guys, you know, they got the straps. They're ready to bind Paul, bend him over the table there and beat him. And it says, and immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him. I can see him going, "Oh, let's say, you know, let's slip out the back door." And because they know they're in trouble, they start whipping him. And the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman and because he had bound him. Now, the Roman commander can be in trouble for this. So the next day, because he wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them. And so he calls now the Sanhedrin, the chief priests, you know, the 70 elders, and there was a mixture of Pharisees and Sadducees in this group. And he wants to hear what these accusations are. Why are they so mad at Paul? What's the deal with this guy? You know, he doesn't know what to do with him. Should I keep him in prison? He doesn't know what to do. So he figures, if his issue is with the Jews, let's have the Jewish council, you know, get some clarification here. Paul looks at this as an opportunity now to share the gospel with these guys that were his brothers some 20 years before this. He was a member of the same council. He probably the older guys there, they estimate here Paul's about 60 years old. He would have known some of these guys, you know. And so it says, then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." You know, I've done nothing wrong before God here. Then the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall." A reference to a whitewashed wall. Jesus had used this kind of reference when he was talking about the Pharisees, and he's talking to them, talking about them being hypocrites. The Jews would whitewash the tombs, and normally they were caves that they would bury people in. You know, you might have a family cave. Jesus was buried in, you know, the cave of Simon. No, it wasn't Simon. Joseph Arimathea, that was the name, yeah. I knew it was a J word. In his cave, his family tomb, you know. And it was unclean for a Jew to touch a dead body or touch anything that had anything to do with death. So in these feast times, when these millions and millions of people are coming into Jerusalem, they would whitewash the tombs to mark the graveyards. And so on the outward, they're whitewashed. They look white and clean and all. But inside, there was dead man's bones. And Jesus equated them as the Pharisees were hypocrites like that. They look really good on the outside. And the inside, they were dead man's bones. Paul uses that same reference here. You're a whitewashed wall, he says to the high priest. For you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law? And here again, Jewish law said you could not strike or punish a prisoner unless they were convicted. Paul hadn't been convicted of anything yet. So the high priest is slapping the mouth, you know, swat, you know. Paul says, you whitewashed wall, you're not even following the Jewish laws. And those who stood by him said, do you revile God's high priest? Then Paul said, I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. This is one of the passages, and there's a couple of them in Galatians Paul refers to when he goes into Galatia. You know, he went in being weak and sick, and he said, and you would have given your own eyes for my benefit if you were able to. It's thought that one of Paul's maladies, and maybe his thorn in the flesh, was the fact that he had eye disease and was poor of eyesight. You know, and apparently there was an eye disease that was prevalent in that time where your eyes would seep and weep and everything would be blurry. So it's very possible that he looked up at the high priest and couldn't tell who he was, you know. And so he says, I didn't know he was the high priest. And so he actually apologizes. He says, for it's written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people. But when Paul perceived that one part of the group were Sadducees and the other part were Pharisees, he cried out in the council, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. So his dad was a Pharisee. And concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged. I'm here being judged because of the hope and the resurrection of the dead. You know, he'd always preach Jesus and his resurrection. And when he said this, a dissension now arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. You know, they hated each other too. The liberals and the conservatives. And the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confessed both. Then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes of the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, we find no evil in this man. But if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let's not fight against God. And when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the barracks. So Paul sets off the third riot. He sets the Pharisees against the Sadducees, you know. He says, I'm here because of the resurrection of the dead. And the Sadducees are going, there is no resurrection. And the Pharisees are going, yeah, there's a resurrection. If an angel spoke to this guy, who are we to judge him, you know? And so this whole thing breaks out again, and off they go. And the commander's going, oh, I can't believe it. Let's get him out of here again. It's the third time this guy's rescued Paul. Let's bring him back into the barracks. At this point, from this next verse, you got to know Paul is really, really discouraged. You know, he had come into Jerusalem really hoping to be able to share the gospel and that Israel might be saved. He wrote to the Romans. He says, it's my desire that all of Israel would be saved. He says, if I could give up my salvation so that my brother and sister Jews could be saved, he says, I would willingly do it. His heart was for these people. And now he's had three opportunities, he thought, to share the gospel. And every one of them ended up in a riot. Paul's sitting in prison. And he's got to be like, what's going on here? And he's done. He's out of it. You know, he's brokenhearted. The following night, and I love the Lord. You know, the Lord is just always there whenever you need him. He's always there all the time, but especially, Lord, when you need him, you know. So the following night, the Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul. For as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome." This isn't the end, Paul. I still got work for you to do. You wanted to go to Rome, I'm going to let you go to Rome. You're going to be a witness for me there in Rome. You know. So Paul knows. You know, there was one other time when the Lord spoke to Paul and said, "Paul," I think it was at Corinth, I think, where he said, "Paul, just be bold because I got a lot of people in this city and you're going to be okay, you know." You don't have to worry about somebody stabbing you in the back. You know, you'll be fine. So here he says, "Paul, you've been faithful. You've done your best. I told you these people weren't going to listen to you. I told them that all the way back in chapter 9, you know. But he said, "I'm going to send you to Rome." That must have just brightened Paul's heart up, man. That must have just brought so much joy and cheer to his heart, you know, thinking he's an abject failure. I have, you know, and a lot of commentators take the position that Paul made a mistake going to Jerusalem. You know, he'd been warned and warned and warned. You know, and Paul was like, I'm going. I don't care what you tell me. You're breaking my heart, but I'm still going. I don't care if I got to go and die, you know. And a lot of people feel it was a mistake. I would never say it was a mistake or not. That's between Paul and the Lord, you know. I can't judge another man's servant, you know. I know there's times in my life when I thought, this is what I got to do. This is what the Lord telling me to do. And I got into it, and it was a mess, you know. And I thought, man, did I make a mistake? You know, and yet all the things pointed towards doing that thing, you know. And yet somehow the Lord redeems even our mistakes if we do them, you know, with the right intentions and the right heart, you know. And so Paul is like at his depths, and he's probably sitting there going, man, should I have listened to Agabus? Should I have listened to the Ephesian elders when they were telling me not to go? You know, did I just blow this thing, you know, and is it over? You know, is this the end? Am I just going to... Paul, in some of his writings, talks about not wanting to end up a failure, you know. He says, I don't want to, after all that I've done and all the Lord's done through me, I don't want to be cast aside. And he's probably sitting there in prison going, everything I didn't want is coming to pass. I'm being cast aside. It's all over. It's all done. Or Snapple. You're going to Rome, dude. And in fact, it's going to be all expense paid, and you don't know it yet, you know? I got some experiences for you yet, Paul. It ain't over, you know? And so that just must have encouraged Paul's heart. It's like, okay, I'll be okay. Now I can sleep, you know? I'm going to leave it there. I encourage you to read. It gets more interesting, believe me. From verse 12 through chapter 24 for next week. The Lord is so gracious. You know, Paul would write in Romans 8:28, and sometimes it becomes cliche for us. But he wrote, all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. And even when we're in the midst of a situation, it just, you know, we think we've totally blown it. We've totally failed. You know, God can't be in this situation. He is. You know, he knows our hearts. He knows his purposes. He knows things so much better than we do. You know, he picks us up, dusts us off, and says, hey, come on. You know, you might have fallen on your face, you know, but let's get going. You know, and he picks us up, cleans us off, sends us off again. He's so gracious. He's so good. Lord, thank you for your word. Lord, we've never